This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. We'd like to hear from you. Talk at talklouisiana.org. Our email signature support comes from Brian Lowe Financial. And speaking of the financial markets, they are roiling again today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average in early trading today down 944 points. It's at 24,822. It's already going into today been the worst week in the history of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The other markets are doing poorly as well. The NASDAQ is off 270 points. And on a percentage basis, that's even higher. Well, it's 3.16%. The Dow's off 3.66% in early trading today. But the stock market is responding to the coronavirus. And Paul Arrigo, the Visit Baton Rouge head honcho, is with us to talk about what's going on. He recently was awarded a distinct honor, a civic award, from the Louisiana American Italian Sports Hall of Fame in New Orleans last week. And speaking of sports, there's our stories, many of them, that the Olympics could be in peril this year. Headline in the New York Times, the Tokyo Games will go on, or will they? And then there's another story saying that Asia's Soccer Federation announced 3 weeks ago that the matches in its biggest club championships involving teams would not be played for several months, and Vietnam has banned the hosting of any sporting events this month, forcing more games to be disrupted. So this could affect America, and it could affect football, meaning the Saints and LSU. We have to just wait and see where this virus is going. But Paul Arrigo, obviously this will affect tourism one way or the other. Are you bracing for the coronavirus?
Well, you know, Jim, we've obviously been following it. We know that there has been some cancellations of meetings on the West Coast. I think San Francisco had a couple of conferences canceled. From a international travel point of view, we were just starting to get into, and I'm not specifying China, let's just talk Asia in general, but the Chinese market, which was you know, a huge market, huge travel market just because of the numbers, we were looking at pursuing more so that market, particularly with the nonstop flights that are between China and Houston and between China and Dallas. And although it is not a major market for us at this time, I think it's certainly going to postpone our efforts to pursue that market. So we have to see what happens. And you're right, this could be a worldwide issue, absolutely.
And we had John Barry, the noted historian who wrote Rising Tide, and he also wrote a book about the 1918 flu pandemic that 27% of the world's population was infected in the year of 1918 through 1920. And sporting events were canceled. And there was no Stanley Cup championship in 1918, just for an example. The baseball season went on. The NFL wasn't even around then, was it?
It's 100 years old.
No, it was not.
100 years old, right.
It was not
right.
Around
okay.
in 1918. So football was not as big in our culture then. But it is something that worst-case scenario is very bad. We probably won't reach that, but we could. And the economy will be affected, and I would think your industry would be affected most.
Obviously, travel and trade would be affected, more so international destinations, those cities like San Francisco, New Orleans, Atlanta, what have you. But we would certainly play off of the travel into New Orleans. Now, the vast majority of our international travel comes from Canada and Europe. But again, this could absolutely be a huge effect on us. Now, conversely, does that mean that the traveler would tend to stay the local? The domestic travelers would tend to stay domestic rather than travel abroad? And does that open opportunities for domestic destinations and locations like Baton Rouge? Certainly something that kind of got thrown at us within the last several weeks.
It's a wait-and-see proposition, but obviously preparations have to be made, contingency plans if possible, and in some cases we know that they're really not possible. This is just a wait-and-see thing that we'll have to follow, and we will right here and everywhere, and the country is riveted to this. People are engaged and interested and uncertain.
Yeah, you know, Jim, something, an effect that I think we could feel We have increased, we have been fortunate, we as a city have been fortunate to increase the number of riverboat stops up and down the river. I mean, next year we could have as many as, 80,000 visitors coming from the riverboats, and many of those are international travelers. Now, they get on in New Orleans and go up to Memphis and back, but they visit the museums and the attractions and what have you, and that could certainly have an effect on the number of passengers, and something we're concerned about. Sure, absolutely.
Well, on a cheerier note, it was a good year, and of course LSU had a national championship season, and that always helps business, doesn't it?
A couple things exciting about the LSU national championship. First and foremost, I think it was good for the state. I think the fact that the L in LSU is Louisiana. I think the brand Louisiana was really broadcast throughout the country and throughout the world to a certain extent. That whole borough and EAUX and GAUX really got spread out, and the fact that on any given Saturday, somewhere on national TV, the term Baton Rouge was used, and it was used in a positive way. We also saw not only an increased number of people coming in for the football games, but the length of stays, and obviously the revenue for the hotels seemed to be considerably higher. Going into 2020, assuming everything is status quo, Jim, it would be wonderful if we had the same year. It would be wonderful if we had the excitement that we had this year. Being the realistic person that I am, I am looking forward to three weekends next year that I think will have a positive impact on Baton Rouge and the visitation. Obviously, Texas, and I think everybody is excited about Texas coming here. Alabama. And what do you think the third team is that I'm most excited about?
Coming to Baton Rouge
this year. Uh-huh.
This year?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned Alabama and Texas. Those are the two biggies.
Uh-huh.
But LSU's on the road this year at Florida.
At Florida and at Auburn. We've got the Mississippi schools
here. A&M.
At A&M.
Those are the last two games, by the way.
South Carolina, I think, is going to have a much bigger impact than we would have thought. Because I think they haven't been here in several years, and they travel well.
Remember Steve Spurrier's last game was a loss here. That game had to be moved because of a hurricane.
Right.
And South Carolina has been in the Southeastern Conference. This will be the 29th year, and they've never won. Joined in 92 with Arkansas. Neither team has ever won an SEC title in football, South Carolina or Arkansas.
They've played. Arkansas has played, have they not?
Played what?
In the SEC championship game.
They played, but they haven't won it,
mm-hmm.
and they haven't won an SEC title. Vanderbilt's never won an SEC title. They were one of the league's founding members.
Uh-huh.
Mississippi State's only won once. Kentucky's only won twice. And Texas A&M and Missouri have never won a title. They haven't been in the league that long. So that's seven schools collectively with three championships, half the league with three championships. Tulane, which has not been in the league since 1965, has three SEC championships in football. As many as seven schools combined. So does that mean we should bring the Greenies back and kick out one of these non-performers?
What about Georgia Tech, and what was the other
Georgia
team?
Georgia Tech won five. Sewanee. Yeah. Georgia Tech won five SEC titles.
I knew you would know Sewanee, Jim. I just didn't know if you knew what year they came in or left.
They came in. I don't remember when they left, but they came in. They were one of the early. You're laughing about Sewanee. Why are you laughing about Sewanee?
It's just that I'll guarantee you that of your very intelligent audience, very few people know there is a Sewanee or that it was in the SEC. And I don't even know where it's located. I think it's in South Carolina or Alabama, huh?
Sewanee?
Yeah.
Matt Doyle? Who's all of 28 years old? I think he knows. He's telling me he knows where Sewanee is located, and it is a school that is not what it used to be.
Isn't it a military school? Or was
I
it
think it is private Episcopal Liberal Arts College in Tennessee. So.
There you go. We were both wrong. It's so, amazing how smart those telephones are.
You're the one who said it was a. You said it was a. A military school.
Sure.
in South Carolina.
And that's right.
It's an Episcopal Liberal Arts College in Tennessee.
Well, Jim, your phone proved me wrong. I'm sorry. But going back to some more serious things, we're excited about a couple things. You know, we've kicked off 2020 very well. We hosted a big Beta Club convention, and you would appreciate this. We hosted a regional championship of the U.S. I hope I say this right. Quidditch. You know what Quidditch competition is?
I tell you, you're stumping me right and left here.
We had a U.S. Quidditch, and then coming up next month in early March, this city is very, very proud and honored.
Well, you buried the lead. What's Quidditch? Is it something to do with Harry Potter?
I'm
not even going to my phone here. Is it Harry Potter?
Yes. It's guys that run around with broomsticks and squat at things. But, I mean, the fact that we had it in Baton Rouge and they had several colleges here competing, and LSU played very well. They're going on to the national championship. But let's go back to things that we know more about.
Okay, we'll do that when we return with Paul Arrigo, the Hall of Famer. He returns to talk about tourism. If you'd like to join us, 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Paul Arrigo in the house, the head of Visit Baton Rouge for a little while longer. And he's had quite a success story to tell. Native New Orleanian, when he was in New Orleans, his name was Paul Arrigo, but mm-hmm. he came this way and he became Arrigo. But he is still an Italian of great pride and now is a Hall of Fame Italian. And he is here to talk about the tourism story, which has been a good one. And Paul in Opelousas, speaking of tourism, my friend Jim Gates, who lives in Opelousas, calls it Mayberry. But Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning. And good morning to your guests. Just a question. Bayou Super Country Fest, why it didn't make it, and really right now, Baton Rouge, national-wise, a big music festival, isn't there yet. But why didn't Super Country...
All right, you're fading on us a bit, but Paul asks about why Bayou Country Superfest is moving out. What's going on?
Well, I think when you look at something like Bayou Country Superfest, when it was put together some 10 years ago, it was it included a cooperative effort by, at that time, the city administration, the State Office of Tourism, LSU, and Visit Baton Rouge. Let's just say that those four entities were not together to put that together this year, although we were certainly there interested in bringing Bayou Country Superfest back to Baton Rouge, and we're making an effort right now to pursue similar events, and I think that hopefully in a not-too-distant future you'll hear about some of those announcements.
Here's Barry in Livingston, speaking of Bayou Country Superfest, saying, how will this coronavirus affect Jazz Fest? You know, you got hundreds of thousands of people congregated. Can you?
You know, I thought about that for Mardi Gras, Jim. I was watching Mardi Gras on TV, and you know, you're talking about millions of people. I don't know, and let me tell you, Jazz Fest is certainly a branded event that affects the entire state. It will certainly be obviously a concern of the producer, who is a friend of mine, Quint Davis, and I think as was to bring up unfortunate incidences, as was the Las Vegas shooting several years ago, which affected the country fest out there. So this is certainly something we weren't looking forward to, and we certainly didn't expect, but we're going to have to prepare ourselves for.
877-217-5757 for Paul Arrigo, a passionate man who has made Baton Rouge his home for many years, and a lot of people from New Orleans have trouble adjusting. You seem to have done it rather well.
You know, I went to, before moving here, I was in Washington, D.C. for 9 years. So, you know, getting away from New Orleans.
That's a great city, too.
I can tell you what, and I'll say this on your radio show, and you can quote me, it can be in a newspaper, I would move back to Washington before I'd move back to New Orleans. Really? I loved Washington.
Great walking city.
Oh, dining, shopping, entertainment, and everybody spending somebody else's money up there, Jim.
And, you know, the industry, as we know, it's corrupt. Politics, but it's clean.
Well, I thought you were talking about the hospitality
industry.
It's
clean. It's clean. There are no smokestacks. So the air is a lot better in Washington, D.C. than it is in some other places.
Papers, lawyers, and lobbyists.
Yeah. Okay, Bill downtown. Bill, you're on the air with Paul Arrigo. Hi, Bill.
Hey, University of the South in Sewanee.
Yeah, yeah. We had a few people who have sent emails chiding me for not knowing. And it was Paul who didn't know, and then he asked me if I knew, and I didn't. But several people.
It was started by a bunch of Confederate generals to educate their children. They still actually attend classes in academic robes, and they have a really beautiful cathedral-sized chapel there.
And you know their colors are purple and gold?
That I did not know.
That's why LSU had, and their nickname's the Tigers. So we couldn't have two purple and gold Tigers in the SEC. Had to get Sewanee out of the lodge.
Do they still have a football team?
I think they do, but obviously
they score
not.
Any points.
But they're athletics. Sewanee was a charter member of the Southern Intercollegiate Athletic Association in 1894, and in 2012, the College Football Hall of Fame held a vote of the greatest historic teams of all time. The 1899 Iron Men beat the 1961 Crimson Tide as the greatest team of all time. So Sewanee won for the greatest team in the history of college football.
Until this year when LSU, I think.
Yeah, the 2019 LSU Tigers will be, I think, right there as the greatest team in the history of college football.
I think
football.
So, Jim. It's certainly one of the most admired and I think nationally and internationally followed and loved. But let me mention this real quick, Jim, because I think this is very important. It has a lot to do with the international travel. We are hosting an event here in Baton Rouge that we're not only honored, but we're humbled to have Baton Rouge hosting something called Travel South Domestic Showcase. Now, that's going to bring in over 700 tour operators and journalists from throughout the U.S. who sell the South as a destination. So it gives us an opportunity now to pursue additional domestic business into Baton Rouge. And they're going to be in town for almost a week in early March, and we're going to really showcase this community as a visitor destination.
That's March of
this year.
This year,
yes,
like
sir.
Next month. Like
right after my birthday, which is March 5th.
March 5th. I heard your father was born on March 5th.
Too. Different years, but absolutely.
I would hope so. Stan at LSU. Stan, good morning. You're on with Paul. Hi, Stan.
Yeah. Yes, this is Stan. I wanted to speak up about Sewanee, too. It was actually formed before the Civil War. The Civil War intervened, but it was formed by Episcopal bishops. But interestingly, you mentioned a little bit ago, Sewanee wasn't what it used to be. True, maybe in football, but Sewanee has 26 Rhodes Scholars in its history, compared to 14 at LSU, so I think it stands pretty well.
Yeah,
it only has about 1,100 students, maybe a few more with the seminary and the graduate school and the
all right, Stan,
and literature.
Are you a Sewanee Tiger?
I am a Sewanee Tiger.
I thought so.
Great.
I thought so.
26 Rhodes Scholars?
26 Rhodes
That's
Scholars.
a first team, a second team, and a specialty team that mm-hmm. they could form with those
yeah.
Jim, you should have a special show on Sewanee.
But as an LSU guy, I want a university the football team can be proud of.
Well, they have a very good Division III or NAIA football team that does quite well. But they did never win in the short period of time, a founding member of the SEC, but the short period of time they were in the SEC, they never won a game.
Well, congratulations on the Sewanee trivia, the University of the South now, and certainly this is a fine university. And when I said it isn't what it used to be, I meant in football. And I'm according to what I have, the undergraduate enrollment is now up to 1653. Postgraduates 184. So Paul,
that Paul was this, Paul?
Isn't it? Paul, both Pauls. This is Stan, by the way. Paul was earlier, mm-hmm. but it is amazing how many listeners from the University of the South are listening to this show. And you wouldn't see the emails that I'm getting on this. We have listeners far and wide representing this great country of ours, and they're congregated right here in our little city
of Baton
Rouge. You
should get the Sewanee Convention and Visitors Bureau as a sponsor, Jim.
I think that's your job. That's your job to bring the University of South alumni here for a reunion.
We're going to hook them up with LSU for a football game, and I'll tell you what, I'll be willing to give up my tickets just to have some Sewanee people here.
This all started about a conversation regarding Tulane. Tulane University. Remember Eddie Price?
Oh, I do. Eddie Price had a bar in New Orleans called the Eddie Price's, or was it the Boot? And he was in the publishing business.
Yeah.
He was bookmaking.
Speaking of, this is a tragedy, but you must have known him, Vince Marinello. Courtney has asked me about Vince Marinello, an Italian who was a great sportscaster who went awry, killed his wife, and died in jail this week.
As a point of trivia, there were two Vince Marinellos in New Orleans. I think they were cousins. One was an attorney, and I think that this was a sportscaster. They resembled each other. Jim, let me tell you what else is coming up since we're finished with Swanee and Vince Marinello. We're getting into what I am surprised to be a huge attraction for Baton Rouge, particularly when it comes to our internet searches, et cetera, and that's going green for St. Patrick's Day. That parade is really getting big. And something that they're going to be doing is kicking off the parade group will be painting shamrocks downtown on 3rd Street next week in hopes that we're going to go ahead and promote that event.
All right, a few more minutes with Paul Arrigo when we continue after this timeout for the news. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Paul Arrigo of Visit Baton Rouge is wrapping it up, and then we'll hear from Aaron Carr, an amazing book called Strung Out. But Paul Arrigo, this Sewanee thing opened up a whole can of worms here. A listener asked if Occidental College, which is where Jim Mora and Barack Obama went, and Jack Kemp, was a tiger with purple and gold. I'm looking up, they're orange and black. They're not purple and gold. But Sewanee and LSU, purple and gold tigers.
Wow.
Not enough room in the SEC for two of those.
No.
But you got another big event I know you want to mention.
Big event starting April 1 at the Raising Cane's River Center for the entire month of April. And this, of course, spans Easter weekend and all the festivals that will be coming in April. It is the recreated work of Michelangelo, the Sistine Chapel.
And Michelangelo?
I have been told it is not Michelangelo. It's Michelangelo. And this will be at the River Center throughout the month of April, and it's going to be an exciting opportunity for our folks to showcase, for this city to showcase to visitors not only what we have as from an art point of view, but for your listeners to invite their out-of-town guests and family to visit that. They're going to literally walk through the artist's work is displayed on special fabric webs along the ground to bring true-to-life reproduction of the art. And rather than looking up at the ceilings of the Sistine Chapel, the exhibit called Michelangelo, A Different View, will have you walking and looking down at the works. And tickets are on sale now at the River Center, Raising Cane's River Center, are on $17. I think this is a tremendous, great opportunity.
Well, congratulations.
23 years. 18 as president.
Okay. Well, congratulations. Let's keep talking. Rob Carpenter gets the final word. Go Tigers, Sewanee Tigers.
Oh, baby.
I've got all these Sewanee people here. It's just amazing. But anyway, that's wonderful. Our guest is Aaron Carr, as we segue from Paul to a remarkable author. She is a person with a great story. It's one that, of course, is affecting many people in America and across the world, but especially in this country, opioid addiction. Aaron says, I write about things like addiction, recovery, mental health, relationships, parenting, infertility, self-care, and my undying love for Beverly Hills 90210. Aaron Carr, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Your book is Strung Out, and it is, as I said, it's a serious book, One Last Hit and Other Lies That Nearly Killed Me. You had a 15-year addiction journey that, of course, brought many horrid things to your life, and you're here to talk about it. But tell us about your story regarding how this all evolved in your life.
Sure. So I started using heroin at a very young age. I was 13 the first time that I used. Before that, I had already tried an opioid. I found an expired painkiller when I was 8 years old and in the midst of a panic attack, which I didn't know was a panic attack at the time. I took it. It helped me. It made me feel better. And I had already started sort of that pill-seeking behavior at that point. From the age of 13 till 23, I hid my addiction from nearly everyone in my life, my parents, almost every friend, boyfriends, teachers. I really looked like I had it all together on the outside. And part of the reason I was able to hide it for so long is because to the people around me, I didn't look what they thought a drug addict looked like. I had straight A's. I was a cheerleader, a horseback rider, a volleyball player. When I got caught at 23, I went to rehab for the first time, and it took me another 5 years of continuously relapsing and another trip to rehab to finally get to the place where I could stop. And it's now been 17 years.
When you decided to stop and then had these relapses, how frustrating, how devastating was it that you had not yet kicked it?
It was absolutely devastating. And I think that, you know, one of the things when we talk about destigmatizing the topic of addiction, we need to talk about destigmatizing the topic of relapse. While it's not a requirement for a recovery, it's definitely a normal part of the process. 80% of people who go to rehab relapse. That's a very high percentage. And I think that what happens is that with every relapse, there was more shame piled on top of shame, and that shame is really a deterrent for people actually getting help.
And when people relapse when they're addicted to heroin, it's particularly dangerous, isn't it?
Yes, it's very dangerous. You know, it's one of the reasons that I'm a big fan of harm reduction programs. Harm reduction programs include things like medically assisted treatment, safe injection sites, needle exchange programs, Narcan training. This is the drug that reverses overdoses, and fentanyl testing strips. Right now, with the proliferation of fentanyl in the heroin supply in this country, it's the overdose rate is very high. 130 Americans die every day from an opioid overdose. So this is definitely a move that we need to make towards more and more funding for harm reduction, because we can't help people recover if they're dead. If we keep them alive, there's a chance. 130 Americans die every day.
Yeah, and we've been talking about the coronavirus for good reason, but
right.
Think about that. 130 people are dying of opioid addiction every day. Every
yes.
day. Imagine if this were a virus, how this would be treated.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is that, you know, we need to look at addiction as a health issue. It is a health issue. This is not a moral failing. These are human beings struggling with a very human condition. People turn to opioids, they're painkillers, right? And they turn to them for pain, but they're turning to them for emotional pain. So we really need to treat what's at the core of addiction, because the drugs are really symptomatic of a larger problem.
Well, the opioid crisis is believed to be responsible for 47,000 deaths a year mm-hmm. in this country.
Mm-hmm.
In this
yes.
country alone, nearly two-thirds yeah. of all the drug-related deaths in the country. And I'm told that this actually surpasses the number of homicides by guns. And so it is a crisis that is affecting all sectors, all gender, both genders, all racial demographic groups. It is a widespread crisis. Why is it not getting as much attention as you might think?
I mean, I think that to a certain extent it is getting more attention. But I think that there's still so much stigma attached to it. If you look online at comments on articles about the opioid crisis, people have very harsh judgment about people who are addicted to drugs. And, you know, that goes back to that message that this is a health issue. This is not somebody who is of poor morals. This is somebody who is in the throes of something that would fall under a mental health category. And I think that that's why a big part of the reason that I wrote this book is that when you meet me, you don't look at me and think, oh, she looks like a drug addict. And I think it's really, really important for somebody like me to continue speaking out about this, because it makes other people more comfortable talking about it. You know, when we try and keep things hidden and pretend that they're not happening, it doesn't help anybody.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to join the conversation. Some more time with Erin Carr. Her book is Strung Out, One Last Hit and Other Lies That Nearly Killed Me. Mike in Broadmoor. Mike, you're on the air with Erin. Good morning to you.
Good morning. And, I mean, so far it sounded so great, your book. I got to get a hold of it. But I just wanted to say that this morning I am happy, joyous, and free. And that the words, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. When I broke that down about 18 years ago and really understood what it was telling me, my problems, along with a lot of other things, service work and different people helping me, it if I make it till April the 14th, I'll have 18 years, and the last 16 have just been great. My question being, does a 12-step program help someone on a drug as strong as fentanyl?
All right. Thank you, Mike. What about a 12-step program? Does it help this?
Yeah, I think the 12 steps are a really good foundation for recovery. It certainly was the foundation of my recovery early on. That said, I think that what we have to realize is that I don't know that there's a one-size-fits-all solution. And that's often because many people, particularly people that are addicted to opioids statistically, are also dealing with some sort of mental health issue like depression, anxiety. There's a high incidence of PTSD from childhood trauma among opioid users. And if we don't address those issues in aftercare with a mental health professional, the incidence of relapse is very high because of that. That was certainly the case for me. I had to go to years of therapy and addressing my own childhood trauma and my own depression and anxiety to finally be able to have something like a 12-step program truly work. It definitely works for so many people. It's free. It's available around the world, and I highly suggest that people try it out. But I think that we also need to have, we need to make available long-term aftercare by mental health professionals for people, because that's where I see the biggest success rates are with people who have access to that care.
The guest is Aaron Carr for a few more minutes. And Aaron, you now are married with two children, I believe. Living in New York City. When did you feel comfortable enough to get married and have children in the midst of this crisis?
So, you know, I found out I was pregnant with my first son when I was still using, and this was more than 17 years ago. I stopped using while I was pregnant with him, and I didn't know if I would be able to stay off of drugs, but I had committed to myself that I would stay off of drugs during my pregnancy. When I had him, I had a very defining moment that happened for me where I held this baby in my arms and I looked at him and I just had this pulsing thought that I love you more than I hate myself. And it was really the impetus for me then to do all of the hard work that I had to do to stay sober. I'd like to point out that I was able to do so because I had the financial means to access all of that aftercare that I was talking about, which was integral to me being able to stay off of drugs. So it was really the birth of my son that was a catalyst for me, and I feel extremely lucky that that's how it worked out.
We're going to spend a bit more time with Aaron Carr. Your number is 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Aaron Carr. Her book is Strung Out, One Last Hit and Other Lies That Nearly Killed Me. She's had a 15-year battle with opioids that she has conquered, now lives in New York City with her husband and two kids. And Aaron, you made it. Growing up in Los Angeles, the only child of divorced parents, what do you think caused this depression, which ultimately led to addiction?
I think there were a couple of factors. I think that, you know, it may be something that I was just physiologically born with, a propensity towards depression and anxiety. I also experienced sexual abuse at a very young age, at 4 years old, and that created a trauma and PTSD that I didn't deal with until I was an adult. So that certainly set me up for a situation where I was looking for some sort of exit from these overwhelming feelings and the panic that I felt. I've often said that I believe that addiction comes in before drugs are ever introduced. I think that the inclination towards addiction is already there. There are plenty of people who experiment with drugs and don't get addicted. Only one out of every 130 people who are prescribed opioids develop an addiction. So there is a difference inherently in people who have a propensity towards addiction and who don't.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on the air with our guest, Aaron Carr. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. I think it's also important to know that if you have a heroin addict in the family, that person can be a completely different person than the one you know. The heroin really changes the personality and makes them very, you know, desperate to get the fix
All right. Do you want to respond?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. I think that when people are in the throes of active addiction, they do all sorts of things that they wouldn't normally do. While I don't agree with the old sort of tough love model that we had in the 80s and 90s when treating drug addiction, of course it's important to have strong personal boundaries with the people we love when they're in active addiction.
All right. You write an advice column now.
Yes.
About a lot of things, but yeah. you've been through some stuff. I'm sure that helps in your endeavor.
Absolutely. That's the tagline of my advice column is, she's made all the mistakes, so you don't have to.
And you live in New York City. You've spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, the two great cities in America, centers of the universe. They both claim to be and have a case to be made for each. How has that affected you, being you're certainly in the middle of a lot of stuff?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, certainly you could argue that I was exposed to certain things at a young age because of geography. That said, you know, with the time that I started using was pre-opioid crisis, and now there are, you know, thousands and thousands of young girls like me. And this has spread across to rural areas, suburban areas. There's really very little difference in sort of the demographics of where opioid addiction has spread.
What about men and women? Are more men afflicted?
I don't know the exact statistic on how it breaks down. What I do know is that use among young women in the last 10 years has risen by as much as 600% in certain areas. That's a huge, huge number. It's very different from the time that I was, you know, the first time I went to rehab at 23, I was one of three women, and I was the only heroin addict in my rehab. Now you would go, and it would skew very young, and you would see a lot of young women there. So that demographic has drastically changed.
Well, we thank you and commend you for telling your story, Strung Out, The Last Hit, and Other Lies That Nearly Killed Me, from Aaron Carr, a memoir. Appreciate
Thanks.
It. Thank you. Stephanie Land, the New York Times bestselling author, writes a deeply moving and emotional read, Strung Out, challenges our preconceived ideas of what addiction looks like. Thank you. And we're joined now in studio by Claudia Ross, and she is Herb Day chairperson. And when I say Herb Day, this is an event coming, Herb Day 2020. Tell us about what's going to happen regarding this August event.
Well, it's a free event. It's a free event to the public, and it's part of our outreach to educate and inspire our children and citizens to come in and participate in a day filled with, we're going to have over 10,000 herbs there, fresh herbs that are for sale, and we'll also have available for the community, a pixie garden for the children. They will develop and form their own pixie gardens with leprechauns. So, and the children love this event.
All right. It sounds fascinating, but when is Herb Day?
Oh, it is this Saturday.
All right. As in tomorrow,
as
the 29th.
Tomorrow.
Like less than 24 hours until Herb Day.
Yes. Everything is taking place. So we have been blessed with a beautiful day and weather for tomorrow. This event starts at 8 o'clock in the morning,
and
it ends at... Oh, wait, we haven't mentioned that.
No, we haven't.
It starts at the Louisiana Ag Center, Botanical Gardens at Burden, right there on Essen and I-10.
Well, that's certainly the appropriate place to start Herb Day.
Yes.
I would think that's about as great as it gets as far as lush landscape in this area.
Yes.
So you've done this a few times, haven't you?
Well, this is our fifth Herb Day. And the response, it's growing. Each year it gets larger and larger. We are expecting quite a few people today, next Saturday.
Well, next Saturday, as in tomorrow.
As in tomorrow.
As in tomorrow. So to participate, just show up.
Show up. It's free. There'll be music by the Blue Horizons to warm your morning up. There'll be food. Festivities. We'll have vendors and merchants there available for you. And it will just be a great day.
Well, we thank you for joining us very briefly, but certainly an important day in our community. Herb Day tomorrow on Leap Day.
On Leap Day. It's tomorrow, Saturday, from 8 till 2 o'clock.
Okay, at the Burden Center.
At the Burden Center.
Claudia Ross, Herb Day chairperson. And the Dow now is down 841. It's come back a bit, but not much, and it will almost certainly be the worst week in the history of the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the stock market as a whole. And under Donald John Trump, who was bragging at his State of the Union address about a 70% gain in the Dow, which was around 45% at the time, it's now closer to 20% after the drop, 20% in his 3 years plus as president. To put that into perspective, in his 8 years as president, 149% gain in the Dow for Barack Obama, and for William Jefferson Clinton in his 8 years, 229% gain. The Dow actually lost ground during the Bush presidency, the last Bush. But this coronavirus is such that financial people are concerned for good reason, and one of those is the president's chief advisor, Larry Kudlow. And here is Larry Kudlow commenting on what he believed, this is earlier in the week, the coronavirus was doing and how he thought it was under control.
As far as the U.S. is concerned, when you look at this, I mean, you had a little higher head count on the infections because of the cruise ship people coming off. We have contained this. We have contained this. I won't say airtight, but pretty close to airtight. We've done a good job in the United States. Hats off to our public health people. And the other generic point, and I hope we'll explore this, Kelly, is simply this. This is a human tragedy. There's no question. Particularly in China, human tragedy with, you know, thousands of deaths. God look over them. Terrible. And that's the worst part of this. The business side and the economic side, I don't think it's going to be an economic tragedy at all. There'll be some stumbles. We're looking at numbers. It's a little iffy. We might have a clearer picture in the next 2 to 3 weeks. But at the moment, Kelly, the numbers that we're looking at on all these Federal Reserve regional ISMs, today's consumer confidence number, right. There's no supply disruptions yet.
All right. Well, the coronavirus continues to be the big story in the world. It is rocking the stock market and the Dow Jones Industrial Average as we speak, down over 3% today. Is it under 25,000 for the first time in well over a year, 24,959. But as I stated yesterday, to put this in perspective, the low for the Dow after the collapse of the banks in 2008 was 6,500, and that was actually happened in 2009. So 11 years, even with the drop we've had now, it's up 18,000 points. But most of those points, of course, occurred during the presidency of President Obama. And President Trump made this a major issue in his campaign reelection bid, that the Dow was doing well, and now it's not doing well. And this is something that he should not be blamed for. But if you're going to take credit for something, as he was, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, certainly his opponents will be pointing fingers at him, saying that the market is not advancing as he indicated it was, and it never grew 70% under his presidency. And this is the same president who, as a candidate Trump in 2016, pledged to balance the budget. And the deficit has soared to over $1 trillion, with more red ink scheduled for next year, and that was with a robust economy forecast. And now the economy is likely to struggle because of this coronavirus and the implications of it. As we had Paul Arrigo on earlier today, tourism has to suffer immensely as a result of this. And when travel is reduced significantly, it affects the economy. And you can only imagine what will happen if there is a pandemic and it affects sporting events in the fall, which means football. We're going to follow it. It'll be interesting, fascinating, and perhaps perplexing to see how this develops. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. Until Monday, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.